BBC Sounds.
The surrogate will have expenses, and I've seen figures from sort of £4,000 to £17,000, and it will just depend on a surrogate's own personal circumstances. A surrogate cannot profit from surrogacy, it's only costs associated with pregnancy that she can receive.
It's not about having lots of money, it's about being sensible with your money and about planning for the finances that you're going to require in the care of your child going through life. So every family has to face it, and for adoption, it's just another consideration.
This is Clever About Cash, the personal finance podcast from BBC Radio Scotland with Kim McAllister
and Eileen Adamson.
So Linda's been a surrogate 3 times, and she's a trustee of the charity Surrogacy UK. So Linda, could you just explain to us, what is surrogacy?
Okay, so surrogacy is where a woman carries a baby for someone else. There are 2 types of surrogacy. Gestational surrogacy, and that's where intended parents will create their own embryos, usually using a fertility clinic, and those are transferred to the surrogate. That might be with donor eggs or donor sperm, but not both. And there is also traditional surrogacy, and that's where the surrogate donates her own eggs and conceives either using IVF at a fertility clinic or more commonly through artificial insemination at home.
I've always thought that it must be a wonderful thing to do, but there must be a whole lot of different issues around it. What made you decide that you wanted to become a surrogate, Linda?
Well, for me, I felt very fortunate that my family was complete. And I also really enjoyed the experience of being pregnant and giving birth. I found it really empowering that my body could do that. And I felt that I wanted to share the experience of having a family with other people who it had been more challenging for. And also to know that I would be doing something that would make a long-term impact, I suppose. Yes, maybe a year, 9 months of my life, but then to go on to create parents, but also grandparents, aunties and uncles. There's not many things that you can do in life that have such an impact. So it felt like something very meaningful to me.
Gosh, even listening to that makes me emotional. It's lovely. It's a beautiful description of the impact that you can have by doing something as wonderful as this. Now, you've recently helped a couple in Scotland. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we'd been friends for quite a long time before I offered to be their surrogate. So they're a same-sex couple, and we did gestational surrogacy. We were very fortunate that it worked first transfer. That doesn't always happen in surrogacy, and often it can take more than one attempt. I had a lovely pregnancy. Unfortunately, COVID came in the way, which was a challenge to us because it meant that the guys weren't able to be there for all of the appointments and the scans that they would have liked to have been. But fortunately, things eased last summer. I live in the northeast of England at the moment, and they were able to move down. They actually moved to a house across the road from me. So they were around and able to be there for the birth. And their daughter was born at the end of August, and she's called Eileen.
Oh, wow. There you go.
Great
there
name.
There you go. Great name indeed, Jess.
That's a wonderful story. You said that they were friends of yours, so that's obviously a lovely way to do it. But if you wanted to look at surrogacy, what's the process for finding a surrogate?
Within the UK, you can join an organisation like Surrogacy UK, which is a community of people, and that gives an opportunity for people to meet. There are no guarantees. It's not like a dating agency. You aren't matched with someone. It just creates that environment where people can form bonds. There are other organisations within the UK, like Brilliant Beginnings, My Surrogacy Journey, where they will take a more active process in terms of matching intended parents with a surrogate. And then there is independent surrogacy, where some people may choose to meet via Facebook groups and that kind of thing. It is unlawful in the UK to advertise that you're looking for a surrogate. It's a very, very old piece of law, but it's all surrounded by ensuring that surrogacy in the UK remains altruistic and isn't commercial in any sense. So it's not permitted to advertise. There will always be more parents looking than there will be surrogates available. At Surrogacy UK, what we do is, rather than have a set sort of waiting list, we have a ratio, so there are always three couples for every one surrogate who is actively looking, which gives people a reasonable chance of being chosen. But as I say, there are no guarantees, so there's a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, I almost don't really want to ask you about the costs associated with surrogacy, because as you say, it's such a beautiful thing, and it must be altruistic. You can understand that completely, but I imagine there are some costs associated. So could you maybe run through those with us?
Yeah, absolutely. So costs do vary depending on whether it's straight or traditional surrogacy with a surrogate using their own egg, or host surrogacy. So roughly the cost of straight surrogacy, we would recommend budgeting about £20,000 for, and for host surrogacy, £30,000 to £35,000. Now that could really vary depending on IVF costs. We have quite often with couples within Scotland, they may receive IVF funding through the NHS. So it's in England, it's very rare to receive funding for IVF, but it's much more common in Scotland that you would receive funding for the IVF element, which can reduce the costs significantly. But that's dependent on a number of different factors. If the IVF costs are funded, obviously that does reduce the costs. So the type of costs would be joining a surrogacy organisation. So there are some administration fees associated with that. So that might be around £1,200 or more if you're joining an agency which are actually going to actively match you with someone. And then there's the cost of the surrogate's expenses. So as I mentioned, it can only be altruistic within the UK, but a surrogate will have expenses such as the costs of time off work, the costs of childcare for her own children, maternity clothes, food, and those kind of things. Now, they vary very widely, and I've seen figures from sort of £4,000 to £17,000, and it will just depend on a surrogate's own personal circumstances, how many children she has, and that kind of thing. A surrogate cannot profit from surrogacy. It's only the costs associated with pregnancy that she can receive, and that, as a surrogate, that's all I would ever want to receive, because, you know, we do it because we want to help create a family. And then, as I mentioned, the other costs would be, if you don't join an organisation and you choose to do it independently, you would want to fund things like DBS checks and medical checks. So surrogacy organisations will usually cover that, but if you're pursuing it independently, you'd have to look at those costs. And then things like wills and life insurance need to be considered. So there needs to be a will in place to ensure that the intentions of the surrogate are clear within the will should she pass away. And then also some contingency funds should there be unexpected circumstances. So most surrogates, for example, will plan their pregnancy expenses around the previous birth, but if they needed a cesarean section and they hadn't planned for that, there could be additional costs that would need to be covered by a contingency. And then the final cost would be the cost of obtaining a parental order, which is required for the parents to become the legal parents of the child. And those costs do vary. They are higher in Scotland. In England, it's a few £100. In Scotland, it is higher, but usually the whole process is less than £1,000 for those fees of processing things through the courts.
Gosh, you just don't think of all these different costs at all, do you? Really, there's huge different costs here. Now, you said up to £30,000 for surrogacy. So what happens if someone can't afford that? Is it just door closed for them?
Not necessarily. So often what intended parents will do is save for a long period of time. The first couple I helped, they rented out their spare room on Airbnb in order to save up. You know, they will make sacrifices in other areas like holidays and things like that, for example, in order to save up. And it's also worth noting that the costs don't all come as a lump sum. A surrogate's expenses, for example, are paid in 10 equal instalments across the pregnancy. So that's not a lump sum that's paid. It is gradually over the course of the pregnancy.
Ah, that certainly makes it more manageable for people, so that's good to know.
Yeah, and in terms of the IVF process, often intended parents will create embryos first, so they've already dealt with the IVF costs should they not be able to access NHS funding. So there's different ways to spread the cost over a period of time.
And are there special insurances that you can take out, for example, you know, if things go wrong or if a relationship breaks down or if, you know, just the unexpected happens? Is there a kind of surrogacy insurance?
Unfortunately not. There isn't anything like that. Obviously, there's things like life insurance and critical illness, which could potentially cover a surrogate's expenses and the costs to their family should the absolute worst happen in very rare cases. But there isn't any sort of insurance cover. This is why we would always recommend that intended parents do have a reserve and have some contingency there. And for some people, they do have to set a limit, so hopefully the IVF route will work after the first transfer, but it doesn't always, and statistically it's more likely to work the second time. But some people will need to set a personal limit if that goes to, you know, the third or fourth try. And we do find in Surrogacy UK sometimes teams will switch from IVF to traditional surrogacy with a surrogate using their own eggs, which is more affordable in terms of it avoids the IVF costs. But that's not for everyone, and not all surrogates will be comfortable with traditional surrogacy.
And what about maternity leave? Because there's effectively two mothers, you know, potentially four parents involved here. How does that work?
Yeah, so a surrogate is entitled to full maternity leave. So when I mentioned about surrogates' expenses, the intended parents would be covering the cost of the difference between the surrogate's normal wage and any maternity pay or allowance that they're entitled to. Intended parents are able to claim adoption leave, and at most companies they will mirror the maternity provisions within their adoption policy, but that's something worth checking in advance. And unfortunately for self-employed parents, there is no pay or leave under the current law, although a self-employed woman could claim maternity allowance, there is no equivalent of adoption allowance, for example, for self-employed parents. So that's something to give consideration to. People can take shared parental leave, which is paid, but it's usually just at the statutory rate. Employers don't enhance that as often, but again, this is something that Surrogacy UK are campaigning and encouraging employers to see surrogacy and also adoption, of course, you know, as these are means of family building, and really the benefits offered through maternity should be mirrored in any other provision for people who have to build their families in a different way.
There's so many questions I want to talk to you about and so many issues round here, Linda. It's just fascinating to hear about it. But we need to focus on the costs and we need to focus on the reality, because at the end of the day, that's what we're about on this show. What does it cost you each time that you help someone out?
So in terms of my expenses, so they vary depending on my own circumstances during the journey, but I would say that the average has been about £12,000. So that's been things like the difference between my maternity pay and my actual salary. I do have a professional job, so where there've been differences, but also that's been if my husband's needed to take time off work. He's self-employed and took time off work to support me after the birth. So costs like that, like maternity clothes, food and things like that. And then before the pregnancy, there are those costs with things like attending the clinic, again, which there's no paid leave for, so that does need to be covered, and childcare and those kinds of costs.
Yeah, but it's obviously that's the cost to you. It's not that you make any money from that. That is just simply covering your costs as £12,000.
It's only the expenses, yes. And as part of the parental order, the court reporter will want to know that the surrogate hasn't been left out of pocket as a result of being a surrogate or at any detriment, but also that they haven't received any payments, because to do so may mean that they aren't giving their consent. in a free way. And that's really important, that informed consent is given by the surrogate for the parental order to be granted. So it's very important that the parental order is achieved through them being comfortable that the surrogate isn't in a vulnerable position, for example. But no surrogate wants to make money. It's difficult enough even having the expenses reimbursed. But when you look at it, you know, when I talked to my intended parents about it, one of them said to me, well, actually, you know, for us, we want to do this because we're covering the costs of our child in the same way that we will for nursery and school uniforms. It's just that it starts a bit earlier for us. And that helped me, I think, process it. But also when I think about it, you know, the people that I spend my money on are my kids. So if I, you know, I was to be out of pocket, it's them who would feel that impact. So I think that kind of helped me make peace with it is appropriate that those costs are covered and I'm not out of pocket.
We've got two Stephens now, so this isn't going to be confusing at all. We've got Stephen Small from St Andrew's Children's Society, and we're also joined by Stephen, who became a parent through adoption. So Stephen, who's the parent through adoption, when you were considering adopting a child, what thought did you give to the costs associated with it?
I guess my husband and I, before we even approached St Andrew's Children's Society, had a discussion about our own kind of finances, and luckily my husband and I are both teachers, so we are both full-time teachers. And we had the kind of job security even during before lockdown, and I think we kind of openly discussed that together. And then as soon as we went to our first information evening with St Andrew's Children's Society, they basically made it clear to us that it would be something we would need to look at and something we need to discuss. We both had savings, and we both, our mortgage was kind of going well, and we had no real debt. And so I think just having that kind of security before we approached the society, before they kind of got into the actual nitty gritty of going through the adoption process. But I think just be honest with, and if, especially if you're a single adopter, just kind of look at your kind of financial situation and your kind of financial security. And I guess it's like, you don't know what child will come with you, or what child you'll end up being adopted, or sorry, you'll take into your care. You don't know what age they'll be. You don't know if you'll have to take more time off than you would expect, considering their needs, etc. I think we also were very lucky that we had really, really flexible bosses, and are really understanding bosses who were kind of really, if we needed time off to go through for like information evenings, etc. They were really, really, really good at kind of supporting that.
Now, Stephen, what guidance does your organisation give to prospective adopters regarding costs?
Everybody, when they're considering bringing a child into the world, whether it's through birth or through adoption, has to consider, have we got the financial acumen to manage what is, as everyone knows, quite an expensive process, raising a child. And so I suppose what we say is we need people to be able to prove that money won't be another stress, because undoubtedly parenting a child that you don't know everything about when they come to you is going to be stressful. And if we can avoid at least the stress of, if is money going to be too tight or whatever, then that's certainly a consideration. And we would always try and kind of emphasise that. But I would also say that we should never be in a position where people are concerned that they can't afford to consider adoption, because it's not about having lots of money. It's about being sensible with your money and about planning for the finances that you're going to require in the care of your child going through life. So every family has to face it. And for adoption, it's just another consideration, I think.
So what kind of costs would you be saying to people that they need to start thinking about?
Children that come to adoption are generally coming from foster care and will bring stuff with them, whether that's clothing, toys, prams, car seats, those kind of things. Those things might come. So there's no point in rushing out to buy things like that. The important thing is that people understand about adoption. It's actually illegal for anybody to be charged to have a child placed with them. So there's no charge to adopt a child at all. That would be wrong. Children are not commodities and shouldn't be seen in that way. The only actual cost that people, we can tell them right at the start, they're going to have to incur, is that there is a lodgement fee when you petition the Sheriff Court in Scotland to adopt your child. So you have to pay a legal fee to start the adoption process. And that has to be the adopter, because the adopter is the person who's adopting the child. And currently that fee's £132. So it's not a huge amount of money. And we would always say to people, even if you were struggling a bit with that, we could look about how we could help you with that. So that shouldn't be a bar. There are legal costs associated with adopting a child, but generally the local authority who's responsible for placing the child with you should be meeting all of those costs and should be supportive of the adopter, so that the adopter doesn't have the financial worry of the court and legal processes. I suppose the other thing just to add is that there are, as with any parent, you have a right to statutory adoption leave and adoption pay, which is roughly equivalent to maternity benefits and maternity leave.
So are you saying that being on a low income is not a barrier to adopting a child at all?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, what we're looking for are people who can show us that they have the knowledge and understanding about the particular challenges that adopted children may face, having had usually early adverse life experiences. So it's about their parenting skills, and it's not about how well off they are or how nice their house is or what kind of car they drive. I mean, clearly what they have to have is a standard of living that means that the child will be well cared for and nurtured, and finance hopefully won't be too much of a stress on the adopters as they grow up, as I'd said earlier. So yeah, exactly.
Now, people are reluctant to talk about money, and it's something that people really don't like sharing with other people. So how much do you actually need to know about a prospective adopter's financial situation?
Yeah, I think the other Stephen could probably say how nosy we are about all of that.
No stone is left unturned.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, what we would say is that we ask people to give us, you know, a kind of rundown of their income, their outgoings, what's left, if anything, at the end of the month, so what their savings might be, really just a sense of kind of their financial sort of health and probity. Stephen's saying, you know, they didn't have any debts to speak of. They didn't, you know, I mean, people, we're not saying people shouldn't have debts such as car loans, mortgages, those kinds of things that everybody or most people will probably carry that level of debt. What would we be concerned about, I suppose, if people had run up a huge amount of personal debt? Because the worry is that's a stress. That's something that people, something else that people would have to worry about while worrying about the care of their child. So we would kind of be a bit concerned if people had that kind of high level of personal debt that they weren't managing.
Also, going back to Eileen's point there about kind of discussing money, the more open and honest you are, the less likely there is to be a stress. Like, it was never a kind of awkward conversation. As I know, kind of people don't really like to talk about money. It's kind of money and politics. But I think when you have that really good, strong relationship with your social worker, and she was open and honest with us, then we're kind of reciprocating that.
The quality of that relationship very much depends on people's openness. And the adopter's saying, I'm a bit worried. Do you think this might be an issue? And we're able to talk it through. And that's much more healthy than feeling that you need to hide stuff from us because you're worried it might have impact on your application.
So for those who are considering going down the fostering route, what should they consider from a financial point of view?
It's quite an important distinction, because foster carers are financially remunerated for the care they provide. So the state recognises that foster care is an important service that the community needs for a small number, but a significant and needy number of children. So the state recognises that and says that we want people to not be put off foster care because they can't afford to do it. So foster carers receive two elements of a payment. One is called their allowances, and those are the monies that are paid to them to meet the sort of weekly costs of caring for a child. So things like, you know, allowing them to keep the child's clothing to a good standard, the costs of joining clubs for children, those kinds of things that parents rightly would be expected to meet the costs of. Foster carers get money provided for that. But on top of that, what they also get is what's called a fee. So they have allowances to care for the child and a fee, which is a kind of payment to them in recognition of their time and commitment. And that varies in depending on the agency that you foster with. But the important principle is that we recognise that people have an element of payment that is not to be spent on the child, but is a recognition of their commitment to the child. So it can be the case that we sometimes get into sort of arguments and fights about money and stuff, because things like different local authorities who place children in foster care have slightly different rules about what they will meet the costs of and what they want. So for a good example that can be an issue would be taking a child to Florida on their holidays, for example. If the foster carers are going, the expectation would be that the costs of taking their foster child with them should be met by the local authority. Now, some local authorities will have a ceiling on how much they'll pay. Some will have a comment that they'll say, we only pay for once in a lifetime type holidays. But the principle being that if the foster carers are going on holiday, that child should benefit from that experience, because that's part of being a family and part of learning experiences for children to have those kinds of holidays. So we can get into arguments about it, but I think we shouldn't, because it should be focused on what's best for the child, and the adults need to kind of get that.
Now, Stephen, I know when I had my kids, I had no idea how expensive they were going to be, and I complain about it fairly frequently. So I'm interested, given that you were probably much more prepared to become a parent than I ever was, have the costs turned out to be higher or lower than you expected?
I guess we were lucky because our social worker visited us the week before kind of lockdown. So actually, over lockdown, we were able to kind of save probably more than we probably would have had life been normal. I guess, as Stephen was saying, we were very lucky that when our son came to stay with us, because he was 2.5 and there was the kind of things like bedding came with him. So his cot, loads of toys, his pram, a really, really excellent pram, which we were really happy about as well. And in lots of ways, because when he moved with us at the end of January, he wasn't going to clubs, we didn't have kind of soft play, etc. So actually, we've been really, really lucky that our son loves being out and about, walking around the park, being curious about the outdoors in lots of ways. And I guess that's where you kind of think, well, you don't have to shower them with money in terms of experiences. Who knows what the future brings in terms of, with any child, be that an adopted child or not. He might be into horse riding, he might be into F1 driving, who knows? And
oh, you'll be wanting a nice car for his 18,
exactly.
And all this stuff.
If you or someone you know has been affected by the issues covered in this episode, there's plenty of advice and support available via the BBC Action Line. Head to bbc.co.uk/actionline.